Good morning. Hal Conklin was born in Oakland, California, in a neighborhood that looked out on the financial districts. And he wasn't in a well-to-do neighborhood. And in looking out from there, he became civic-minded as he thought about how can that money be put to use for more people. And he went to Cal Berkeley. His license plate says democracy. And Hal believes in helping people. We became associated through being members at the Free Methodist Church, and he's been mayor of Santa Barbara after serving on the Santa Barbara City Council, and done that in a distinguished way. Hal cares a great deal about how can we get people to work together and move together. He's been influential in our church at Free Methodist, and he's out now has national and actually international influence in the Free Methodist Church as he quietly works among people to help them see the commonalities we have, and also how can we work together to do the most for the most people. And Hal has broken his leg running from a wildfire in Madagascar, falling in a hole as the fire swept over him, and then the odyssey of a six-day flight back to California to be treated. And he arrives back with a story and a smile and not a woe is me. He is a humble and interesting man. I have my notes ready to be taken every time Hal Conklin speaks. So please warmly welcome Hal Conklin.
Good morning. My name is Hal Conklin, and I'm a political alcoholic. That is to say, I'm someone who got addicted to public life and then found that it actually had harmful effects on me. And I had to go into a 12-step program to get out of it. But I realized in the process that not all of it was bad. Politics is kind of a strange place to end up in your life. It wasn't something I expected to do. It wasn't something I desired to do. And even when it happened, I was a little surprised that I was even there. But when most people think of politics today, they have all kinds of images of what's happening, especially in a political year, when you've got so many interesting, some would call crazy people running for office and calling people names and doing all kinds of strange things. That kind of craziness is what most people think about politics, and they say, either I don't want to have anything to do with it, or I'm really disgusted by it, or I don't actually think that any of these people are frankly even moral, or I don't know what it is that I can do about it. Well, there are things you can do about it, and you have to realize that what you see on television is more theater than it is reality. Now, politics is, I think one of the best definitions I ever heard of politics was that it comes from the word Greek word poly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning little bloodsuckers. When I told my mother I had gotten elected to office, and she didn't know I was even running, she burst into tears, and they weren't of joy. They were of fear, I think, because she didn't like the fact that I was now going to have people saying all kinds of things about me. And she said, why in the world would you want to be a politician? And I said, I don't want to be a politician. I guess, you know, if I was to think about it, I would be more likely to say I wanted to be a statesman. Well, a few hours later, she came back with a dictionary. She said, you know, the definition of a statesman is a dead politician. So get out there and do something before you die and see if you can make a difference. Well, I decided today I was going to speak about the question of how do you be a Christian in a world that is based upon the separation of church and state. And I find that often when I ask people, the question which was asked to me when I was in college, where is the statement about separation of church and state? I often said, and I would often hear, that it was in the First Amendment to the Constitution. The one about freedom of speech and freedom of religion and about separation of church and state. Well, I would suggest you go back and reread the Constitution because there is nothing in the Constitution which ever says the words separation of church and state. Nothing. Well, then where does it come from? It comes from the fact that at the time of the writing of the Bill of Rights, or the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, there was a great deal of fear that either we would slip back into what the Church of England had done, which was to mandate a religion, and either you were part of that church or you were castigated by the government, or that somehow there would be interference of the expression of Christianity, especially in New England, because you had the Maryland folks who were Mary followers or Catholics. You certainly had the Congregationalists in Massachusetts. You had the Unitarians who were coming out of Massachusetts. You had a variety of Puritan or Protestant sects which were coming to this country. But you also had people who had no interest in religion at all. And there was a fear that the government was going to impose some kind of restriction or have something to say about your expression of your faith. And so in 1801, the Danbury, Connecticut Baptist Convention wrote a letter to President Jefferson and said, "What do you expect to come from the First Amendment of the Constitution? Do you think that this is going to, how are we going to be protected from you, the government, saying what we should believe or not say?" And he wrote a long letter back, which is very interesting, and I would commend you to go read it. He wrote it to them on October 7th, 1801, and he explained to them that it was his intent that the government would have nothing to say about your faith, nor would it interfere in any way, and that he was trying to build into the Constitution a wall or a separation of church and state so that the government could not break through that wall and tell you what you should think, feel, or have faith in. Now, is that what you think of as happening today? The fact is that most people think today that the government interferes in their faith all the time and has some expression about what it is that they think or do, and that they think that somehow the First Amendment to the Constitution was not to protect your right to have faith, but it is to protect all of us from you having faith. That can't be farther from the truth. The purpose of the First Amendment was to create a separation of the government having anything to say about what it is you have faith in. And it isn't just for Christians. It meant that in order to give Christians the freedom to worship the way they wanted, we gave everyone the freedom to worship the way they wanted, or not worship at all. But that was the trade-off. Now, when I hear people saying, maybe we should close the door to Muslims, or we should do this, or we should do that, I go, oh my God, please go back and read the Constitution. That has nothing to do with what it means to be a person of faith. Sometimes people think in the Christian world that our role is to be out there winning the battle. I always say that there's a difference between Christians who think that we should be fighting the good fight to make sure that our points are made versus those who, I think rightly so, should be out there living their life to exemplify what a Christian actually is, and that people will see that and say, I want to be like that. Now, there are many fights in this country over symbolism. You know, you read it all the time or you see it in the press. One of my favorites was over the Ten Commandments on the lawn in Alabama, on a courthouse lawn, and the big fight over the symbolism of whether that should be there or not, because if you took it away, that meant we were stopping this to be a Christian nation. Well, the fact is that lots of people love to fight over symbols as opposed to living as a symbol. It might surprise most people if you go to Southern California into Los Angeles, as I did this Christmas, that there's a nativity scene right in the center of Los Angeles, and nobody asks a question about why it's there. If you go over to the Federal Building, right by the LA Catholic Cathedral, the giant Federal Building, there are three giant figures that are 25 feet tall on the front of the Capitol of the Federal Courthouse. The middle one is Moses holding the Ten Commandments. Nobody fights in LA over Moses being on the front of the Federal Building. Don't fight over symbols. Be a symbol. Now, where would we be thinking about Black History Month if it wasn't for the Reverend Martin Luther King exemplifying what it was that his faith was in a world that was attacking people in the South. If it wasn't for the Black church, there would not have been a change in this culture. And it is still changing, but it's only going to change if the new Martin Luther Kings, the new pastors, the new people of Christ stand up just like he did, and all those other pastors who marched and said, this is what we believe. If everyone said to Martin Luther King what we think the press says today about trying to stop people of faith from speaking, there would have been, as there was, a crush of that movement. But the crush of that movement was much more subtle then. And I think that it is really important that we learn from his history what it means to actually be people of faith in this world. It has nothing to do with violating the Constitution. I came from Oakland 50 years ago. It's somewhere back towards the 19th century, I think. And it was a time when I was living in Oakland in college. I had no idea what it was I wanted to do with my life. I had a friend in high school who told me she was going to go to Santa Barbara to Westmont College. And I kept asking where Santa Barbara was. But here I was in Oakland. And the only thing that I knew how to do at that time was to accept a job to be a youth leader in a small, formerly Methodist church in West Oakland that was an all African-American neighborhood. And it was like an after-school program where you taught basketball and played games and kept people off the street because it was a dangerous place on those streets. And I was amazed and actually depressed by the way in which the local government of Oakland didn't actually ever help these kids. And so one day I got a chance through the urging of a pastor to go to a city council meeting and to see if we could ask them for help for these kids. And the response we got was symbolically, the door was slammed in our face. And I walked out of there feeling utterly confounded and certainly depressed by the lack of response of government. But government was the last thing that I had any ability to impact. And I found myself desperately praying that somehow these people would listen. As I prayed, asking God, what is it I can do? I can't do anything in this youth center, and these people are dying on the street. And I felt virtually helpless. Well, one day in the middle of all this, I was asked to go to Santa Cruz and to work with a summer group with some of these same students. And I took some of these students, we actually went and lived in the mountains of Santa Cruz to do a project for a Methodist campground. And it was a rough summer. It was the summer they started the Black Panther Party, and one of my classmates, Huey Newton, started that. And but my job was to go be with these students in the mountains of Santa Cruz. And I came back, and I was still rather dismayed by what it was we were going to do. I couldn't have any real clear picture of what this could be. But in the middle of it, what I thought was not an answer turned out to be the answer. As I couldn't hear a clear picture of what it was I thought that God should be telling me to go do, I got a notice from the draft board that I was about to be sent to Vietnam. Or I could accept a job for 6 months in Santa Barbara, California. I go, well, that sounded like a much better deal. So I came here for 6 months to work on a project because they had just had a huge oil spill here, and it was now this formidable task of trying to figure out what to do with the degradation of the environment that was happening. So I was sent to work with a government agency that was trying to do some repair of the environment in Santa Barbara. Meanwhile, I would pray that someday when the 6 months was over, I could go back and I could actually help impact these kids. But the more I was here, the more I got drawn into it and sucked into it and was learning a lot, but I just kept getting more and more depressed that somehow I wasn't ever going to get back to Oakland. And then what happens often when you're in your early 20s, I fell in love, and the next thing I knew, I got married, and the next thing I knew, we had a child, and pretty soon I was just totally engaged in trying to do this community work to help the environment, which seemed like now I was in this wealthy community working to do this project which didn't seem to really help a lot of people. It may have helped the environment as a whole, but it wasn't helping a lot of individuals. And I was still focused on these people back in Oakland. Well, in the course of doing that project, I did something which I don't have time to tell you about, but it just got a lot of positive notoriety. And the next thing I knew, in about a four-month period, I was nominated to run for the city council in Santa Barbara. I'd been here about 4 years, and lo and behold, to my shock and dismay, I was elected. And it was a great ego boost, I have to admit, but at the same time, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm married, I have a child, I'm now on the city council in Santa Barbara, I'm never gonna go back and help these kids. Well, the project I had done, which had gotten all this notoriety, got me invited to Sacramento, where I gave some speeches about what it was we had done here to protect the environment. And one of the guys in the audience was the president of Kaiser Aluminum, which happened to be based in Oakland. And he said, would you come and speak to our executives about what it was you did in Santa Barbara? And I said, sure. My parents still live there, and they wanted to see their grandson. So we went up to Oakland, and I gave this speech. But as I walked into the room to give the speech, there was a big picture window. And as I looked out the picture window across Lake Merritt in Oakland, there was the church where I had worked just 5 years earlier. And assembled in this room was the leadership of Oakland. The same people I had gone to the city council meeting to try and influence 5 years earlier, and I felt so depressed when I walked out and prayed that God would give me some voice to be able to speak to them, I realized that God had sent me on this journey in a way that I could not possibly have imagined, to do something I knew nothing about, and then to put me in a place where I could now come back and speak to the leadership of Oakland as an expert, quote unquote, and I could tell them what it was that I thought they should do to help the people of Oakland, and that there's one way that the project I was working on could help them do that. Now, that was a real eye-opener for me, to realize that God answers prayer all the time, but it rarely is the way you think it's going to happen. And when you think about your future and where you're going to go and what you're going to do, it rarely is a direct path from A to B. It's usually A to K or someplace in the middle of the alphabet, and you're going to go on this wild ride all over the place to do things that don't make any sense, and in the end, it will come back to where it is that God wanted you to be and answers your prayer. And 50 years later, I can say with some degree of certainty that every prayer I ever prayed got answered in my life. It just never happened the way I expected it to. But I'll guarantee you this, it happened better than I expected it to. I just had to trust in faith. And that to me was what the metaphor for politics was all about. It had nothing to do with going out and giving speeches and making points about immigrants and all the rest of it. Yes, I know the presidents and the Congress needs to deal with all of that. But there were some things that were more basic than that that I think that we can all learn life lessons from. So I'm going to tell you three things that I think I learned along the way in Santa Barbara, and I think they're applicable to everything else we do. The first is that there are no values in government. There are only values in people who serve in government. It's like being a musical instrument. A clarinet is a beautiful instrument, but when it's sitting there, it's just a piece of wood. When somebody plays it, it sounds like Rhapsody in Blue. There's no values in government except for the values in the people that serve in it. So if you want to know how people are going to serve in government, you need to talk to them about what their values are. 90% of the people in government in the United States are at the local level, 90%. So 90% of the influence of the culture of America is occurring at the local level. How many of you know the values of the people of this community who are running this community? That's where the change is going to occur. It's going to occur at every community level across this country. And if you don't know the values of the people who were there, then you don't really understand how that community is going to be affected. Or, like me, you could be a person who can take your values and put them into that place and make a difference. You can be a catalytic difference in the community you serve, and it will change the politics of America. I am one of four living mayors of Santa Barbara. The other three are all Unitarians, because somewhere in the local Unitarian church, they made the decision they were going to teach people how to be in local government. Well, God bless the Unitarians. I wish the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Baptists would do the same thing. If people of value don't serve in local government, then America will not have people of value in government. The values that are in government today, or the issues that people face, are no different than they were 240 years ago. This country isn't any different than it was during the founding of the country, when you had people of religious fervor coming here for freedom, and at the same time, rugged individualists who wanted stuff for themselves coming here, and forming all kinds of mercantile interests. That dynamic, that me being the rugged individual, or me being a part of a religious community battle, which occurred from 1600 through to the early 1800s, is no different than what's happened since 1900 to 2016. Today, we're faced with the same battle going on. That's just the way it is. So what we need are people who will go and be catalytic elements in that culture. The second thing I learned along the way was that integrity is built on a foundation of faith. So if people of value move into local government and maybe eventually into other levels of government, they bring that integrity with them. Good leaders are facilitators of dialogue. And to be a good facilitator of a dialogue, you have to love other people. That's a basic Christian doctrine. It's easy, though, once you're in public office, to actually let your ego take over, and pretty soon you stop remembering why you're there. I used to be a speaker to all the newly elected officials in California. We had about 200 a year, and they would come together, and I said, what's going to happen to all of you. You are going to spend the first 6 months going, oh my gosh, I'm so humbled by the fact that you voted for me. And it's just a great, great gift for me to be able to be in this place of service. And then over the next 18 months to 2 years, everybody's going to blow smoke in your ear and tell you you're the greatest thing they've ever met. And somewhere along the way, you're going to start to believe it. And then you're going to have an ego which is going to destroy you. C.S. Lewis said the greatest sin is pride or self-conceit, and the virtue opposed to it in Christian morals is called humility. Being humble is the way in which you influence from a Christian perspective. The best example I've ever had of that was Westmont College, when they were going to build the housing next door for the faculty. I had chaired lots of meetings of public debates about building in Santa Barbara. Everybody fights over everything. Someone once told me that public meetings had replaced public hangings as a form of entertainment in the Old West. And I believed it because it was just a battleground. But in 18 years of being in office, the biggest battle I ever faced was the building housing next door to this campus. There were people in this neighborhood who didn't want it to happen. They spent a lot of money and organized a lot of opposition. And it was a case where, in order to get water for Westmont College, they had to annex this property in the county to the adjacent land, which was in the city, so they could get city water. And it happened. But it happened because, under the leadership of David Winter, who was then president, and a number of people who were supporters of this college, lived and worked and spoke with integrity to everyone who opposed the project, never tackling what they had to say, but listening to them and then just sharing why this was important. Now, If you don't know this, local governments don't. The majority of anybody who's on a local government cannot talk to one another before a decision is made. So in the case of Santa Barbara, we have 7 people on the city council, including the mayor, and 4 people can never be connected into a conversation about what's about to happen. Even if it was inadvertent, I talk to one other person, that person talks to one other person, I talk to another person, 4 people are now connected, even though we were never in the room at the same time, we have violated the law. So when a decision is going to get made, sometimes it looks like a bunch of bumbling idiots running around bumping into each other, but that is the first time they've ever had a public conversation together about this subject. You can't do it outside of a public meeting. We had 7 people. The way I counted the vote was, at best, we had 4. I was hoping we had 4 out of the 7, but most likely we had only 3, and I didn't think this would happen. After 5 hours of testimony, the vote was taken, and it was 6-1. Now, I was shocked, frankly. But when we got back to the council out of the council chambers and into our office, I could now talk to everybody and say, why did you do what you did? And those who I went to, who I thought were diametrically opposed to this project, said, you know, I listened to all those people rant and rave, and the people at Westmont never once responded with in kind. They just really listened to what those people had to say, and everything they just, with kindness, responded to it. And they said, it just changed my mind. I couldn't vote against him. That, to me, is what it means to be a Christian in government. Now, let me just say, the final one would be that all politics are local. If you're going to make a difference in politics, it has to be at the local level. It could eventually lead to something bigger, but there's a call, a need for Christians to be on school boards. There's a call or need for people to be on city councils and planning commissions. There's a need for people to be involved in PTAs and a whole variety of ways in which communities are impacted. I think back to that time when I was deciding to come to Santa Barbara, and one thing really struck me in the middle of that time of despair. I was sent to the Santa Cruz Mountains, as I said, and while I was there, one night I was being asked if I would speak to a large group of people about what it was we were doing in Oakland, and I could not figure out what it was I should say, and I was sweating, I was desperately praying for God to give me some word of what I should say. And while I was trying to write it down and nothing was coming, there was a window open next to me in the small cabin I was in, and it was one of these windows you could pull the top sash down and pull the bottom up, and there was a piece, you know, there was a place where the two plates of glass were sort of together with a little space in between, and a sparrow had dropped in between that space and couldn't get out and was banging itself back and forth against this window. And I go, great, I can't figure out what to say, nothing is gelling, and now I got a bird that's driving me crazy, and I got to go rescue this bird. So I go over there, and I just looked at this bird, and I said, man, you got yourself in a lot of trouble here. But the bird wouldn't come out, and it just was beating itself against the glass. So I stuck my hand into the window and tried to grab it, and every time I tried to grab it, it would just fly away. And finally, in exasperation, I just said, you know, if you would just put yourself in my hand, I could lift you out of here. And as soon as I said that, I knew what I had said. And the bird stopped, and the bird got onto my hand, and I lifted it out of the window, and I stuck it out the window. And the bird just sat there and started to sing. And I just started to cry. And then it flew away. And I realized that's really all it takes. You don't need to know the answer. You don't have to have brilliant words. You just need to put yourself in God's hand, and he'll take you where you need to go. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for the opportunity to be of service. We know we don't know the answers. We don't even know what the future holds, but we do know that you know what our talents are and what our gifts are, and they may be very different than what we think. So we just ask that as we place ourselves in your service, and we trust in faith that you know where it is we are to go, that you will give us the power and the vision and the opportunity to move mountains, to make change, even if we have no idea that it's even happening. Use us wherever it is you think we can work best, but we place ourselves in your service. And we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.